John Feinstein's back on the show this afternoon. It seems like we have to book John a couple of times a year because he comes out with a book a couple of times a year. Last year, he came out with one called Next Man Up, A Year Behind the Lines in Today's NFL. And this week, it is out in paperback. Welcome back, John. How are you?
Paul, I'm fine. I'm always delighted to talk to you, but I have to tell you that as a lifelong Mets fan, I'm in great pain.
I would believe you would be after
I know I shouldn't say that when I'm trying to sell books in St. Louis, but I feel in the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that right at the top.
Well, maybe. You know, we want the Cardinals to win this thing, of course, but maybe the Mets' history with Game Sixes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You're absolutely right.
And I believe today's the 20th anniversary of Buckner.
It's the 20th anniversary year, and you've got a Wilson.
The 20th anniversary year, yeah. I know that. I'm trying to remember if today's date is the 20th. I was at that game.
Were you?
Yeah, and you know, the irony of that game for me, and you learn as you go as a reporter, that you don't root so much for, as Jerry Seinfeld would say, laundry, as for people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know, that crazy 10th inning occurred, and people forget, by the way, that the score was tied when Buckner booted the ball. If you go around and ask baseball fans what the score was when Buckner booted the ball, they'll say, well, was it 6-5 or 5-4? No, the game was already tied because of Bob Stanley's wild pitch, and yet Buckner is looked at by so many people as the guy who cost the Red Sox the World Series, when in fact, if he makes the play, the game just goes to the 11th inning. But my assignment that night was the Red Sox clubhouse. And I went in there, you know, and of course, you know, you go in poker-faced. I'm thrilled that the Mets have won and survived. And I stood there next to Bill Buckner for most of an hour. And I watched him deal with wave after wave after wave of reporters. He never snapped at anybody. He had to repeat the same answers God knows how many times, because that's how the World Series is. And he never ducked. He never said, I've had enough. I'm going home. He understood his responsibility. And I walked out of that clubhouse feeling sick for Buckner, because I knew it was something he was going to have to live with the rest of his life, especially if the Mets went on and won, which, of course, they did two nights later after the rainout Sunday night. The Red Sox led that game 3-0 in the sixth inning. People forget that, too. And I just, to this day, I feel great sympathy for Bill Buckner. And it's almost hard for me to enjoy, you know, that extraordinary comeback the Mets had because of the feelings I have for Buckner.
And it really weighed on him for a long time, probably still does now.
You know, I think it was interesting to me when I, in 04, when I heard people saying that Red Sox fans can now forgive Bill Buckner. Well, they should have forgiven him long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a great player. He was a borderline Hall of Fame player. He had almost 2,700 hits. He was a gold glove player until injuries, you know, late in his career. And just a superb hitter, a good defensive player, and a class act. And, you know, he didn't do it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
People should forgive him. And my agent, Esther Newberg, who is one of those fanatic Red Sox fans, and I remember I said to her one time, you know the score was tied when Buckner booted the ball. And she said, don't start with me. I don't want to hear
it. The problem tonight, John, is that the member of the Wilson family is on the other side of the field other
That's
than
true.
The Mets.
That's true. You know, and
Mookie Jr.?
Mookie will not be running out any ground balls for the Mets.
No.
But, you know, the only thing I think the Mets have going for them tonight is it makes no sense for them to win. You know, you've got to figure Carpenter's going to pitch better than he did Friday night. And, you know, John Main has actually not pitched badly for the Mets all year. He's been pretty good. But something in my gut, and maybe it's just, you know, being the romantic that I am, tells me the Mets are going to win this game.
You know, you're a perfect person to talk about this with. It completely has nothing to do with the series or anything. But Kevin was telling me he was at the Dome on Sunday for the Rams-Seahawks game, which had that fantastic catch by
right.
Torrey Holt at the end. That, you know, a highlight of the year kind of moment that turned out, unfortunately, not to be the winning touchdown.
Right.
But, you know, in the press box, it's very different than the rest of the field. And I remember the first time I ever went to a Super Bowl was in San Diego in 1988, the Redskins beat up on the Broncos the Doug Williams Super Bowl.
Yeah, 42-10.
Yeah, I watched the first half of that from the stands, and then my news guy, we had one press pass. He was in the press box, I was in the stands, and at halftime we switched. And I went and I sat in the press box. I hated it because I was a fan, and I wanted to be able to root for my team. And Kevin was saying on Sunday it was so weird that when you're in the press box, you can't even acknowledge that it was a great play. You can't even go, wow, what a fantastic catch.
Yeah, John, they made an announcement. They made it, you know, a reminder to all the members of the press. No
right.
cheering, no,
no
stomping
cheering.
On the ground, and no wowing.
Now, yeah. now you, yeah. you've been in press boxes your entire professional yep. life. How do you stand that?
Well, you know, I'm just used to it at this point. I mean, I as you said, I've been sitting in the press box most of the time. You know, since I was in college. And in fact, the adjustment for me is when I take my son to a game, who's now 12, and he's, you know, up cheering for, you know, the Washington Capitals. He's a big hockey fan, or, you know, Maryland basketball or Duke basketball. He's an anomaly. He likes them both because he knows both coaches. And I just kind of sit there. It's very unnatural to me at this point in my life to cheer. In fact, I went back, and I still go to the Ravens games, and I've become so spoiled by having spent the 2004 season on the sidelines that I still go down and watch from the sidelines because it's a completely different view of the game, and it's far more exciting than being in the press box. Because you're right, Paul, it's a mausoleum up there. And when the Ravens beat the Chargers a couple weeks ago, Todd Heap scored the winning touchdown with 34 seconds to go, and I'm standing there, and I was excited when Heap scored, and all of a sudden somebody bear hugs me from behind, and I look up, it's the team chaplain. And that's not the kind of thing that will happen to you on the, when you're up in the press box.
No, it better not.
I enjoy being on the sidelines. I do remember one very awkward moment during the 2004 season when the Ravens intercepted a pass and returned it for a touchdown, and Kelly Gregg, who's a very good defensive lineman, very underrated player for them, was standing next to me, and he turned around to high-five me, and my instinct was, I can't do this. This is wrong. I'm a reporter. I'm not supposed to high-five anybody. And Kelly sort of in mid-high-five realized that and sort of pulled his arm back. And it was really kind of an awkward moment because he wanted to, you know, react to the play. And I really wanted to react to the play, but I just felt that it was wrong for me to do that. I always figure somebody's watching me and I'm going to get a hard time because in 1984, when I was still full-time at the Washington Post, Duke played North Carolina in the ACC tournament. Michael Jordan was on that team, and it was Mike Krzyzewski's first good team. They were just starting to emerge, and they upset Carolina. Great game, came down the last play, Duke wins. And I'm walking, you know, get up out of my chair, and I'm walking toward the locker room, and I walk by Mike Krzyzewski's family, his wife and three daughters, who I know well. And Mickey Krzyzewski throws her arms around me and hugs me in this great, thrilling moment. And, of course, at that moment, the TV guy decided to go for a shot of Mickey Krzyzewski.
Mm-hmm.
So there I am with Mickey Krzyzewski's arms around me. And it's, what, 22 years later? I still have people come up to me and saying, we saw you hug Mickey Krzyzewski. And I always say, yeah, if a good-looking woman wants to hug me, I'm in no position to say no.
Yeah, better than the chaplain.
A lot better than that.
Yeah. John Feinstein here on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX. His book, Next Man Up, which is all about that year he spent with the Baltimore Ravens, is out in paperback now. I just want to explore one more angle on this press box thing, because what always seemed odd to me about it, and I remember thinking this back in 88 when I was in the press box, which I rarely ever did ever again. I used to do it at Busch Stadium a little bit mm-hmm. for the food. But,
it was not that good, Paul.
It was free.
It's still free at Busch because a lot of
not anymore.
Because most major league teams now they charge you to eat, and the food's not that good.
Yeah, it wasn't that good, but you know, I'm in radio, and free food shows up, I eat it anyway, regardless of its flavor. But here's the thing: when you start out as a sports writer, it's predominantly because you love sports. Most
right.
sports writers I know, as kids, they lived and breathed
right.
sports. They knew all that sort of stuff. It was totally exciting to them to root for their team and all that sort of stuff. So I'm curious about at the beginning of your career. When you first did that and went in the press box
yeah.
and you saw that silence around you, was that hard to adapt to?
Initially it was, but you adapt fairly quickly because you don't want to embarrass yourself.
Yeah, when you're the young guy, the last thing you want is an older guy coming up and
yeah.
hitting you.
If you start jumping up and down, and you know, I mean, when I first started, I was a student reporter at the Duke Chronicle. And, you know, I obviously covered Duke football. And back then, Duke would occasionally win a game.
Mm-hmm.
And Duke basketball. And back then, they would occasionally win a game because they were not very good, believe it or not. And I didn't want to be, you know, I wanted to be in this profession. And I figured if I embarrassed myself in front of people who were potential future employers, it probably wouldn't be a very good thing to do.
Yeah, I could see that being frowned on a little bit. Duke is going to be playing Miami this weekend.
Yeah, because all those Miami players are out, they'll only lose by 30.
I was going to say, Duke actually might only be a 3-touchdown underdog this weekend.
Maybe, yeah, because Miami's going to be playing walk-ons.
Yeah, Kevin, my sports guy, is an alumnus of Miami. He played baseball there, and he actually knew this loudmouth Lamar Thomas who got thrown off the telecast after rooting on the riot the other day.
Yeah, he's in the elevator on the way down right now.
Yeah. Is one game enough? They suspended these guys for one game.
No, one game is not enough. And what the ACC, first of all, I mean, a lot of my ACC friends are saying, you know, oh, this is terrible for the league. And I'm saying they didn't know this was coming. Miami, sorry, no offense, Kevin, but Miami didn't have this history.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is new. Like, they thought they were getting Harvard when they took Miami into the ACC. So I don't want to hear anything about that. But if John Swofford had any guts, and that's kind of an oxymoron, what he would do is he would make an announcement that Miami has embarrassed the ACC, and regardless of its record, it will not participate in postseason this year. Because that way you punish the school. And to me, you know, you got to punish the kids. But you also need to punish the people in charge. And you know, not only was it a bad incident, but at the end of the game, what did the Miami players do? Were they showing any remorse for what happened?
No.
They acting like they beat a real football team, you know, celebrating at midfield. Where was Larry Coker in the interim between the fight and the end of the game? Why didn't he get his team together and say, fellas, we've just embarrassed ourselves, repercussions. As soon as this game is over, we get out of here.
Yeah.
Well, I'm celebrating, we get out of here. And clearly he never did that.
I'd spin it just a little different way, is that the reason they don't cancel games or keep them out of the postseason is because of money. The conference will share in it. The school can't afford to lose it. And if you do that, you're penalizing other student-athletes who rely on football to pay for all of their activities.
You know, Kevin,
but you fire the coach and you hold somebody accountable.
I'm going to tell you why I don't buy that argument for two reasons. Number one, Miami will still share in the ACC bowl money, even if it doesn't participate. As Duke shares in it every year, and then, you know, they'll never be anywhere near a bowl game in the ACC. And the other thing is, it's a little bit overrated, the notion of football paying for other sports. At most schools, and I think Miami is one of them, football basically breaks even because the expenses are so huge. The scholarship bill is so huge. The amount of money they spend traveling the team and keeping them in hotels before home games, which I've never understood, is so big that, you know, if football makes some money, it's not enough money to fund the rest of the programs. And you know what? If they have to dip into their endowment for an extra couple hundred grand because they don't go to a bowl game, so be it.
If it sends a message to the thugs that are that team and the coach who has not been keeping everybody in check, I think that's a great message to send.
The coach is going to be sent a message at the end of the year because he's going to be fired. But it's not because of this brawl. It's because Miami's not winning games the way it used to.
Right. That's the truth.
And isn't it sad that that's the reason? That
that's
it's not
always the criteria, though.
And that's a money thing, too.
You know that as well as Kevin and I do. And,
yep.
You know, I always, you know, I joke around with coaches I know. And I say, look, you could graduate every player you recruit and send them on to Rhodes scholarships. And if you don't have a winning record, you can get fired. And they all know that.
I'm Paul Harris talking with John Feinstein, the terrific sports writer who has a book that is just hitting paperback. We talked about it when it first came out in the hardcover. Now it's out in paperback called Next Man Up. It's a year behind the lines in today's NFL. He spent a year with the Baltimore Ravens, both on and off the field. And what was the team's response when the book came out, John?
Oh, you know, it was very good, Paul, because what I try to do when I write these so-called access books where I'm spending a lot of time with people is I don't want to surprise them. And there were some difficult things I had to write about and some awkward moments and some, you know, clashes between coaches and players. But I made sure that everybody knew that I was going to write about it. I asked them about it. They knew that I was writing, you know, taking notes or taping the interviews. I made sure that, you know, for example, Chris McAllister, the cornerback, was the subject one day in a coach's meeting of a lengthy conversation about his lifestyle. You know, was he partying too much? Was he drinking too much? Had he shown up at practice hungover the week before? Was that the reason he had performed badly in a game against the Bengals? And I went and talked to Chris about it. And I said, you understand I need to write about this in the book? And he said, yes, I do. So there weren't any surprises to them. And in some cases, I think my reporting kind of filled out stories that maybe hadn't been out there in the press. You know, Jamal Lewis, for example, I think people got a different view of him than just some rich athlete who got busted for drugs. I think he comes across much more sympathetic than that, even though he is a rich athlete who got busted, not for drug use, but for setting up someone he thought was his girlfriend, who was an FBI undercover agent, to be able to buy drugs from a friend of his.
when you were there, that was about the time that the whole Terrell Owens, Baltimore or Philadelphia thing was going on. In retrospect, was his not going to the Ravens a good thing for the club?
I think it was. You know, the funny thing is when the coaches and Ozzie Newsome, the general manager, and his scouts met to discuss that subject in February of 2004, when Owens was supposed to become a free agent. You remember the whole fiasco with the paperwork, and he was traded by the 49ers to the Ravens, and then the arbitrator said, no, he's still a free agent. He went to the Eagles. But when the Ravens were discussing the question of whether they should go after him as a free agent, Billick said in the meeting, look, fellas, we know if we go after this guy that he's going to blow up in our face at some point. It's just who he is. The question is, do we get to a Super Bowl before the blow-up? Is it worth the risk? Is it worth making the deal with the devil? And ultimately, they decided it was worth the risk, and that's why they went after him, and that's why the Eagles went after him, and that's why the Cowboys signed him, because people will always take risks. And in this case, they didn't even think it was a risk. They thought it was a certainty that he would blow up, but people will always go after talent.
You know, I got a little sore spot in my gut about T.O., and this past Sunday was a perfect example of it. This guy, because of his bad boy reputation, obviously the spotlight loves to follow the bad boy.
Yep.
And on Sunday for the Cowboys, he had 3 touchdown passes that he caught, and you know, that's a big day. You know, so did Torrey Holt.
Mm-hmm.
The Rams receiver had 3 touchdown passes that he caught as well. Where's the attention on Torrey Holt, who I think is probably the best receiver in the game right now?
But you know the answer to the question.
He's not a bad boy.
It's a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is. And I thought it was interesting. You know, I was flipping around Sunday afternoon, and Parcells' press conference came in, and it was very clear he didn't want to talk about Terrell Owens. You know, he wanted to move on. You know, we had a good win. The team played well. Terrell played well. I'm happy he played well. Next question. And I don't blame him for that, because I think most people in football are pretty sick and tired of talking about Terrell Owens, and with good reason.
Yeah. I know I am. Let's move on. Have you talked to Kornheiser about his Monday night gig?
Oh, yeah.
Because last time you and I talked, when your U.S. Open book came out in August, he had just done a little preseason and was about to start it off, and we talked about that.
Right.
What has he told you about the experience?
Well, I think he's kind of settling into it. I think he's feeling more comfortable, as you would expect, from week to week in the booth. The travel's tough. He's on a 35-day trip right now. You know, he flew to Denver, which, of course, he hates.
Oh, he must have been so doped up to do that.
And then he got on the bus to go to Arizona, and now he's busing to Dallas, and then he's going to, I think, fly to Minnesota, and then he has to fly to Seattle. So there's like 4 plane trips on this.
It's Tony's nightmare.
Yeah, no, it's his worst nightmare. But I think he feels it's getting better. It's, you know, he and Theismann and Tirico have to develop a rhythm, as always happens when something is new. I frankly think, Paul, and I've said this to Tony, I'm not saying it behind his back, that the biggest problem is, you know, you've got so many people whose egos need to be fed on that telecast. You've got to get the sideline reporters in. My belief is the only thing that's worse than a sideline reporter is 2 sideline reporters. You know, you've got to take care of Berman and his crew at halftime. They've got to get their minutes on the air. And that time, that extra time, is where Tony can shine. Because you know from doing comedy that you can't do it in 12-second bites.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
Yep.
And Tony, you know, if you give him a little bit of time and a little bit of space, he will make you laugh. Now, he's going to do fine, because the guy he's going to be compared to is Dennis Miller. And Tony has 2 things going for him over Dennis Miller. 1, he knows something about football.
Yep.
And 2, he's funny.
No, he's great, John, because he tweaks Theismann. And I just love that. He tweaked him the other night, you know, during the Bears-Cardinals game, because Theismann was contradicting himself, saying the Cardinals should go conservative and run, at the same time as saying they should stay aggressive. And Tony's like, which is it, Joe? Come on.
And he needs to do more of that.
Yeah.
And Joe, kind of temperament that Joe doesn't have the kind of ego where he's going to get all angry with Tony for doing that. And he'll learn to go back at Tony. And that, you know, that will evolve, you know, much the way, I'm not comparing it, but Meredith and Cosell evolved as an on-air relationship. And once that starts happening, it will be much better for the telecast and better, frankly, for both of them.
I agree. And by the way, the ratings, huge. Number one show on
Kid. You know what? And I'm biased because he's my friend. I mean, some of it is they've had good games.
Yes.
You know, good games are critical. If you have bad games, people are going to bed.
Yeah.
You know? But That's part of it. But the other part of it is hiring Tony was a masterstroke by ESPN because it gave them a buzz for this that no one else could have. If they had just hired, you know, another ex-jock or another ex-coach, it's another ex-jock or another ex-coach. This was a big story. You know, this was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. This was all over the place because it was a different kind of move, much the same way Miller got them buzz. The problem was, you know, as soon as people listened to him for 30 seconds, they were like, what is going on here?
Well, they could have hired John Feinstein.
No, they couldn't have because I wouldn't do that kind of travel. And I really, you know, I'll be honest with you, Paul, I have no interest in doing television. I love doing what I do.
When's the next book coming out?
Sorry?
When's the next book coming out?
The next book will be out in the spring. It's on PGA Tour qualifying school. You know, I went to all three stages of Q School last year. Think that Q School is just the finals because they see it on the Golf Channel. There are two stages of Q School that come before the finals that are even more tension-filled than the finals, if that's humanly possible. And it was a fascinating project, and the book's called Tales from Q School and be out, you know, April, May.
All right, we'll talk about that when it comes out. And how about another kids' book? You did one for the Final Four. You did one for the U.S. Open. What else?
Yeah, Vanishing Act is actually doing great. You had me on last month to talk about it. And I'm working on another one. The third one is set at the Super Bowl. Stevie and Susan Carroll both go. Interestingly, Stevie at the beginning of the book gets fired by a cable television network that may bear some resemblance to ESPN. And then the rest of the plot evolves, and there's an evil team owner of a fictional team whose name is Don Meeker, but he's known around the league, interestingly enough, as Little Donnie.
Hmm.
We have an owner near where I live who's known as Little Danny.
Little Danny. I know. Mr. Snyder there.
Yeah.
All right, John. It's always a pleasure having you on. I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks. Good to talk to you guys.
John Feinstein's book, Next Man Up, A Year Behind the Lines in Today's NFL, is out in paperback now. Everything he writes is terrific, and it's always a pleasure having him here on KMOX.